It's Tuesday, April 6th, and Oracle never saw this coming. We start here. In a landmark decision that could shape how tech works, the Supreme Court says it's not stealing, it's building.
This really comes down to 12,000 lines of code.
How you see this case might depend on whether you're an entrepreneur or a consumer and what kind of smartphone you own. Prince William and Harry might have problems, but one didn't try to steal a whole country.
If there's one thing we've learned about coups in the Middle East, you kind of need the military to be on side.
Did a blood feud almost become a coup in the Middle East? And its history was buried for 99 years, but maybe not 100.
Tell the story right, and don't tell it white.
As America wrestles with racial violence, one city is coming to terms with its own massacre. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. I manage to forget this every year, but every year the stock markets close for Good Friday. The government is open for its business, just not the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange. Well, last Friday, with stock markets closed, the government happened to report its best jobs numbers in months.
The new jobs report shows the U.S. added 916,000 jobs in the month of March. That's the largest gain since August and well above what analysts were expecting.
And so yesterday morning, Monday, we finally saw how Wall Street felt about it.
Stocks set new benchmarks to start the week. The Dow closed at a record high.
We're seeing this recovery trade, if you will, continuing to play out in very good form indeed.
But as optimistic as investors were, for average Americans, it's becoming clear that things are not just going back to normal soon or perhaps ever. People are figuring out they might never go back to their office. Companies are realizing they might not pay for the same amount of real estate ever again. E-commerce took such a leap forward, it's now just commerce. And in this digital-first world, entire economies could rise and fall just based on what rules tech companies will have to follow.
It's been called the biggest copyright case of the century.
Case 18956, Google versus Oracle.
Well, yesterday, in a blockbuster decision, the Supreme Court overturned a lower court ruling to make a sweeping change to how we think of who can build the stuff that we all use and how much we might all end up paying for it. So let's start the show with ABC's chief business and technology correspondent, Rebecca Jarvis. Rebecca, this was a case between Google and Oracle, right? The big tech companies has dragged on for like a decade. It's done now, right? What happened?
It's over, Brad. And Google emerged the victor in all of this. And this really comes down to 12,000 lines of code that Google used to build Android, its mobile operating system. And the important thing is where those 12,000 lines of code came from. They were copied from Java. Right. And of course, Java is used to develop web applications. Java is owned by Oracle. So for the last decade, Oracle and Google have been fighting over whether or not Google has to pay Oracle some amount of money, perhaps as much as $9 billion, because it used the code from Java in order to build Android.
All kinds of people use Android to do all kinds of things. And with Google Assistant on your Android device, doing them is all kinds of easy.
Now, Google used a tiny, tiny portion of the overall code. In fact, the estimates are that it took 0.4% of Java code, and then they turned it into this transformative thing that we all know as Android. I mean, a lot of people probably are listening to this podcast right now via an Android phone.
There is no copyright protection for computer code that is the only way to perform those functions.
So the court ultimately decided that because both the type of code and the amount of code was so small, so minuscule, that it was protected under fair use.
You didn't have to have a QWERTY keyboard on typewriters at the beginning. But my God, if you let somebody have a copyright on that now, they would control all typewriters.
Justice Stephen Breyer, who wrote the majority opinion, said that Google took only what was needed to allow users to put their accrued talents to work in a new and transformative program.
Breyer argued that Google would risk public harm if it was punished for copying that code, since so much of software development in general relies on these building blocks, using other people's code to advance that innovation.
And the reason that you care about this, the reason we've been following this, that the outcome has an impact, is because there are hundreds of thousands of companies right now that are building applications, things we might end up using in the future. And they are making decisions about whether whether or not to borrow code from other places, because of course, technology builds off of itself. And this decision says the particular type of code that can be borrowed in small doses and to potentially transformative ends under fair use law. And the argument is that it's good for innovation, and this decision encourages that.
The opinion from Justice Breyer said the better way to look at the numbers is to take into account the several million lines that Google did not copy. In dissent, Justice Thomas said the majority's fair use analysis is wholly inconsistent with the substantial protection Congress gave to computer code.
Well, and so who is this good for? Besides Google and Oracle, I get it's good for Google, it's bad for Oracle. And a bunch of tech people were like, hey, this is a big deal for the little guy. Will you explain that to me, Rebecca? Like, how is Google in any way emblematic of the little guy?
So it's kind of mixed if you think about this. It's not necessarily good if you're a small business that built really juicy code that then Google can use to build something else.
Right.
But if you're a consumer and you have nothing to do with any of these technology companies other than the fact that you're a customer and you use them, you may end up seeing more technology as a result of this decision. It's that idea of building off of itself. Mm. Progress takes time. Building out code takes time. And if companies have to pay large amounts of money in order to borrow small pieces of code from each other to build completely transformative and different products, that could ultimately mean less innovation, less new things for consumers. At the same time, if you're a startup, suddenly you're worried about the fact that Google or any major tech company can come along and take a piece of something that you have built, incorporate it into their product, and not have to pay you for the right to do that.
That will hurt app developers and the industry in the long run, because who will invest the excruciating time it takes to refine code from the passable to the masterful if all of it can be stolen?
Oracle came out immediately after this decision was handed down and said they stole Java and spent a decade litigating as only a monopolist can. And that is in reference to Google. And the concern here is the power and might now that a decision like this can hand to the major tech companies and what that could mean in their relationship to startups and small businesses that might have something special. Can they go after them? Can they take it? But the benefit of a decision like this is that it means for consumers, you and I, that we might get better technology and greater innovation because technology and progress is building on itself.
Yeah, and you look at this ruling, this was not just liberals versus conservatives or anything. Like, this was 6-2. Amy Coney Barrett wasn't there, but President Trump's other two appointees actually sided with the liberals along with John Roberts. In the other corner, you had Justice Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito saying that Oracle should have won this. They actually issued their own opinion, which could also just shed light into how the Supreme Court is thinking about tech. Because again, tech rules are economic rules, essentially, when we're talking about big companies going forward. Rebecca Jarvis, thank you.
Thank you, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, they were supposed to be the easy family to deal with, but the Kingdom of Jordan says it just thwarted a coup attempt from within the palace. We're back in a bit. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you ever doubt how something on the other side of the world can affect you, I was at this little cafe in my neighborhood yesterday. It was super sunny outside, and so I asked the manager if they were going to put up umbrellas or something. He looked at me and he said, "Suez Canal, man." That's right, the manager of this cafe was telling me because of this huge backlog of ships in the Suez Canal in Egypt last week, they might not get their umbrellas here in Brooklyn for another month. Events in the Middle East can quickly reverberate.
We're seized now to a royal feud that has caused a crisis in Jordan, a close U.S. ally in the Middle East.
And of all the countries that make up the Middle East, the one often called the stable one is the Kingdom of Jordan. Well, right now, Jordan is quickly responding to what it's calling an attempted coup.
I wanted to make this recording so that it is clear to the world that what you see and hear in terms of the official line is not a reflection of the realities on the ground.
ABC's foreign correspondent James Longman joins us from London. And James, all of a sudden people were waking up to news that people were being arrested in the Kingdom of Jordan. What is happening there?
Yeah, Brad, look, normally, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about rifts between princes. And often that means the Harry and William here in the United Kingdom. But we're talking about a rift between a different couple of princes. They are King Abdullah II, the King of Jordan, and his half-brother, Prince Hamza. And it's basically a story about the falling out of these two men. There is a lot of history here, but let's just take a look at what happened over the weekend. We heard reports that there had been essentially a coup, an effort to dethrone King Abdullah II, and it had allegedly been plotted by Prince Hamza, his half-brother.
I should not leave my house, that I could only visit family, that I could not tweet, and that I could not communicate with people.
Hamza said that he was under house arrest. That was something that the Jordanian authorities denied. But essentially, the allegation is that along with at least 16 other people and possibly the help of foreign entities, Hamza tried to get rid of King Abdullah.
I'm making this recording today to try to explain what's happened over the last few hours.
We then had a whole series of videos from Prince Hamza saying that he wouldn't comply to the orders he'd been given by the Hashemite kingdom.
I am not the person responsible for the breakdown in governance.
We then had a lot of vocal support for King Abdullah and the regime there.
Tonight, the Biden administration saying it stands by King Abdullah after authorities there accused his half-brother and the former crown prince Hamza of attempting to destabilize the government.
The United Kingdom, Gulf states all rallied round. And now, in the last few hours, the last 24 hours, we've had a letter apparently signed by Hamza saying, "I place myself in the hands of His Majesty the King, and I will remain committed to the constitution of the dear Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan." So it seems to be there's now been a 180.
Wait, so then if you're the King of Jordan and if you're the allies of the Kingdom of Jordan, you're essentially saying everything's good then. Back to where we started, coup averted.
That's right. They're trying to deal with this as a family. Where have we heard that before? Hamza is drawing attention to some uncomfortable truths about Jordan. You know, we think of it as being this stable place, but actually it is a police state. There are hugely important issues around corruption, around nepotism. There is unrest in this kingdom around King Abdullah. He's not as popular as his father was. I do have to say, though, a lot of people watching this are asking themselves if this was a coup at all. One major issue is that the military doesn't seem to have been involved at all. If there's one thing we've learned about coups in the Middle East, you kind of need the military to be on side. They don't seem to have been involved in this at all. So could this be coup-proofing? Could this be an embattled King Abdullah sending a bit of a message to his people to say, look, I know you're not happy at the moment. I know the economy is struggling. I know the COVID pandemic has hit us hard. But if any of you are thinking about pushing me out, just watch. I can take your favorite prince and put him under house arrest.
Oh, like this so, might not look, be the most serious coup attempt a Middle Eastern country's ever seen, but you might as well make an example just to, in case there is a serious one out there, might as well make an example of them.
Absolutely. There's a historic issue between these two men, and maybe he's just nipping it in the bud early. It's important because Jordan is an enormously important US ally. It is a rock of stability in a region of endless war and conflict.
The United States and Jordan, of course, share the mutual goal of a negotiated two-state solution in which Israel lives in peace and security alongside a viable Palestinian state.
Half of Jordanians pretty much are Palestinians. It's been a haven for Iraqi and Syrian refugees as well.
Jordan has helped to make progress towards a political transition in Syria, ensuring the enduring defeat of ISIS as well.
It has a massive intelligence gathering capability, which the West often plugs into. So Jordan's important. And if overnight a royal family like this falls away, or at least a king is dethroned, that's really, really significant for the Middle East.
Yeah, and you look at some of the countries in the Middle East that the U.S. really relies on. Jordan, we talked about, who knows what's happening there. Israel, we're supposed to see eye to eye with their government. Well, as of this week, they still don't really have a functioning government. They've been doing like do-over votes for 2 years at this point. And leaders in Turkey, hugely important, are now reporting in the last 24 hours they might have just had an attempted coup on their hands. At least that's how they're portraying it. So a lot of uncertainty in some really important areas right now. James Longman, keeping an eye on it. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Yesterday, we continued to hear dramatic testimony in the case against former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin.
Was this a trained Minneapolis Police Department defensive tactics technique?
It is not.
Minneapolis Chief of Police Madera Arredondo testifying against one of his former officers, telling the jury that what Derek Chauvin did to George Floyd violated the policy and values of the department.
We also continue to get reaction at the private level and the corporate level to these new voting laws in the state of Georgia. And really, the message echoing from Minnesota to Georgia is a similar one, that this is a moment of reckoning.
What does it mean to be black in America?
What it means to be black in America means that you're criminal. I feel that being black in America is illegal.
Activists in Minneapolis are saying this is not the story of one dead man on the street. It's a question of whether police can physically assault you and get away with it. It's not a question of longer lines at the polling places, they're saying in Georgia. It's whether you can restrict all the things that just happened to enhance black voter turnout. And there might be no better example of one thing disguised as another than what for a long time was known as the Tulsa race riots.
We have trauma that has been passed down for decades now.
Historians say that was actually never the right thing to call it because it obscures what actually happened.
If you're gonna tell the story right and don't tell it white.
Which is why we now know it as the Tulsa Race Massacre. And later tonight on ABC, Steve Osunsami is reporting on this, an in-depth piece for the primetime show Soul of a Nation. But you don't have to wait that long, because this morning, his new podcast about this topic has dropped. It's called Tulsa's Buried Truth. Steve joins us now. And Steve, I feel like it was right after the death of George Floyd that a lot of Americans were pointing to this moment in Tulsa, a different state, almost 100 years ago. But people were pointing to it as something to draw on. Why is that? Like, what is it about these events?
Well, I would say that George Floyd changed the conversation that was happening in this country on race, without question. And what started happening is that we started looking at stories like what happened in Tulsa through a new lens.
Still, it burned down Brian's tailor shop.
So there are now Hollywood TV shows that have focused on what happened.
Best Negro surgeon in all America.
HBO's series Lovecraft Country and Watchmen have both focused on what happened in Tulsa. And then, of course, our podcast, where we really go into depth about what happened, why it happened, and why it was kept a secret for so long. In 1921, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, there was a a very well-to-do black community known as the Greenwood neighborhood. And what happened is freed slaves who left the Southeast set up these different communities, these freedom towns, as they were called, in communities across America.
The Greenwood community as a business community was a community of necessity. There would have been no Greenwood community had there not been segregation.
And because of the discrimination of the times, you know, a person who lived in one of these neighborhoods, they couldn't go to a shoe store and try on shoes or go to a dress store and try on clothing. So they formed their own communities and economies. And so this economy in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in the neighborhood called Greenwood, which was on the other side of the train tracks, was so successful that people started calling it Black Wall Street. But what was also happening at the time is, this is after the war, you had white Americans who really resented the community and the people of Greenwood, who were doing better than some white Americans on the other side of the train tracks.
It was a really scandalous, false narrative about an attempted rape in broad daylight in downtown Tulsa.
It all came to a head when a black shoe shiner by the name of Dick Rowland was accused of assaulting a white elevator operator, and then things blew up.
Well, what happened here in Tulsa on May 31st through June 1st of 1921 was indeed 18 hours of terror.
White residents of Tulsa, Oklahoma found their reason to burn Greenwood to the ground.
State-sponsored terrorism, where the sheriff deputized 2,000 to 10,000 members of a white mob that descended upon Greenwood.
People's homes were burned as black people ran out of their homes because of the fires. They were shot dead. By some reports, hundreds of people, hundreds of black Americans were killed.
The people most likely to be shot and killed are people who were defending themselves.
People ran for their lives, never to come back. There were bombs that were dropped from above by white townspeople who ran to their crop dusters nearby and threw Molotov cocktails from above, burning the homes.
And when you see the pictures, the before and after, you know it's like it's a war zone. There's nothing left standing.
This was the execution of black excellence.
I was going to say, it's like you hear about a lynching and you think one or two victims. This was almost the lynching of a town of an identity in a way.
Yes, yes. The execution of black excellence.
I had no idea.
Why is that? How did that happen, in your opinion?
Well, I don't know. I went to Booker T. Washington High School, which was a predominantly black high school that integrated in the early 70s. And it was not even taught at the high school level, at a predominantly black, historically black high school.
And it ended up being the greatest act of domestic terrorism in the state of Oklahoma that very few Americans had ever heard about, because it was kept a secret.
What do you mean by secret?
There were two things that happened. On one hand, white Americans who lived in Tulsa, who were embarrassed by this, didn't want to talk about it. The historians didn't want to talk about it. The newspapers at the time were white-owned.
One of the local newspapers, the Tulsa Tribune, published an editorial 3 days after the massacre. It must not be again. It was horrific, vile language against the black community in that editorial.
Yet they described what happened to Tulsa as a Negro riot. On the other hand, you had black Americans who were afraid for their lives.
They were afraid the same kind of inhumane, savage massacre would take place again.
They had to work, the people who came back, with the very people who burned their homes and who killed their loved ones. And so there was fear in the black community about talking about what happened in Greenwood. And that continued for a very, very long time.
It's heartbreaking. Number one, just to know what they endured in their lifetimes. And then not to be able to go to the grave and give her the due respect that she so deserves, to put flowers on her grave.
And to have a time, a key part, that potentially hundreds of people were killed who were buried somewhere in Tulsa where no one knew, who never saw a funeral, no death records, no official records of where they were buried, lost to their families for what is now a century. So with George Floyd, with this changing conversation, there has been a renewed interest and push for finding these dead bodies.
Thank you, everyone, for being here this afternoon.
And guess what happened in October of last year?
Today, I have the opportunity to report to you that we have now encountered human remains.
They started digging in a couple different locations where there were rumored to be these mass graves, and they found one.
I was absolutely speechless, and that doesn't happen very often.
And so they're now trying to figure out how they can test the DNA of these different bodies and possibly eventually connect them back to the families who still live in Tulsa.
What happens to the town? I mean, to this place that we're talking about that was such a big part of this. You know, you described it as maybe it's better described as a Black Main Street than a Black Wall Street, but it was there, like it existed. And that doesn't necessarily exist in Tulsa or a lot of other communities in this day. Is restoring that part of the agenda? Can it be restored?
You know, when you go to that area that was that's still called Black Wall Street,
everything in Greenwood is pretty much owned by somebody that's not Black.
What's happened is it's been very gentrified.
Tell the story right that on this side of town, the bicycle trails are well lit and well manicured. I know because my mother lives over here.
But on the Black side of town,
it hadn't been maintained.
So I visited earlier in the year and then another visit recently. And in between my two visits, one of the Black business owners who owned like a hair shop, she was complaining to us when we first visited that she could no longer afford the rent. And when I came back again just recently, her business was closed. Mm. She had already moved. So over the years, there's been a lot of talk in the Black community about supporting Black-owned businesses and creating this safe Black space for Black business. History shows that Black Americans had this at one point in cities like Tulsa and other cities across the country, usually as a result of Jim Crow.
Right, like this weird irony of integration happens and now you can go to whatever store you want, but the stores that are thriving, the stores that are doing well, they're white-owned, so now you're patronizing a white-owned store.
Absolutely. Integration changed a lot, and so did the integration of public schools and universities. You know, now all of a sudden, the children of Black Wall Street could go to any school in the country. All of these things changed the nature of having a Black Main Street in communities like this.
You come and look at this history. Come look at it. Come look what happened. What was done to this community. Now, after you are educated and enlightened on it, and then you find out nobody was ever paid in their losses, no one's ever been brought to justice.
But we have to underline that none of the destruction of this generational wealth would have happened if it weren't for this incredible injury. And who, if anyone, should pay for that?
What I have seen over and over again is that people who started out, this ain't nothing but a handout for Black folks, they end up thinking, what can I do to help?
Yeah, that's right. You hear talk about reparations. Joe Biden talks about build back better. The question right now is, will these towns be built back in a different way than we saw just a few years ago? All right, Steve Osunsami, fascinating stuff. It's a great podcast, and it drops today. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, let's take a quick break, and then let's iron out some summer travel plans where you can and can't go. Stick around for one last thing. And one last thing. If you're wondering what your summer travel schedule might look like, the last several days might offer some clues, for better and for worse.
We state that fully vaccinated people can resume travel to low risk to themselves.
First of all, what's safe and what's not? Well, the CDC is now saying that if you're fully vaccinated, and remember, it takes about 2 weeks for the vaccine to fully kick in, but if you're vaxxed up, wearing a mask and socially distancing, you can rest assured that you will not put yourself at risk by traveling. They say don't worry about quarantining before or after. Don't even worry about testing if you're not symptomatic. But like all things with COVID, it's still not that simple. The CDC says just because vaccinated people are safe doesn't mean you should travel. In fact,
they're still recommending you don't, not for your sake, but for everyone else's.
And as cases rise, authorities are taking note of the number of younger people getting this.
Remember, the vaccines are being described as 100% effective at keeping you out of the hospital. It's still not a given that you absolutely cannot spread the virus, and 80% of the country remains at risk.
Right now, the state of Michigan is far and away the most dangerous place to be if you're concerned about getting COVID.
That said, plane reservations are increasing dramatically, faster than some of the air carriers are ready for.
This is my first flight. I got vaccinated a couple of weeks ago.
Marcus Binning landed in Atlanta from Houston Monday afternoon. That vaccine gave him confidence he ended up needing because of what he and other Delta passengers saw once they boarded.
This weekend, Delta found itself without enough pilots to staff all the flights they had just booked.
When I got to my seat, I seen that there were three people sitting in the row.
To keep passengers from getting stranded on Easter weekend, they had to open up middle seats, which is precisely the kind of scene the CDC is so worried about. But if demand was escalating, yesterday, the supply suddenly ran out. A computer glitch halted reservations across the country for Delta, American, United, and many others around the world. Turns out, on the very day of its big court victory, the flight shopping software for Google had crashed. All right, so you can travel, but don't travel. Like, I don't know if that simplifies things for you, but that is the message from the CDC. Don't forget, check out the new podcast, Tulsa's Buried Truth. Incredible stuff. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.